That's Ren Wood singing Burning My Heart Out from the soundtrack of the film The Brother from Another Planet, which was written, directed, and edited by my guest John Sayles. Sayles has established himself as one of the leading independent feature filmmakers. Probably if his films were backed by studios, those studios would have also tried to alter the more offbeat and subtle characteristics of his movies. Return of the Secaucus Seven, Sayles' first independent feature film, takes place at a weekend reunion of 60s activists who are reconciling their ideals with the current circumstances of their personal and professional lives as they enter their 30s. Liana concerns a woman who leaves her university professor husband for her lesbian lover. Baby It's You, Sayles' only studio-backed film, introduced Vincent Spano and Rosanna Arquette as a high school couple from different class and social backgrounds. Sayles' new film, The Brother from Another Planet, is a fable about a black alien who ends up in Harlem, where he tries to blend in while being pursued by two extraterrestrial men in black, one of whom is played by Sayles. At a time when movie costs have soared as high as $30 million and more, Sayles has made most of his films for well under $1 million. He learned the art of low-budget movie-making while writing screenplays like Piranha and Battle Beyond the Stars for the B-movie master Roger Corman. The profits from these films were used by Sayles to finance his independent efforts. Sayles has also been writing for television. Soon to be broadcast are his adaptations of the Gene L. Novel Clan of the Cave Bear and Grace Paley's short story Enormous Changes at the Last Minute. Before writing screenplays, Sayles published short stories and novels. His first published story, I-80 Nebraska, won an O. Henry Award. His second novel, Union Dues, was nominated for a National Book Award. Recently, Sayles received a $150,000 MacArthur Foundation grant. That's the grant that's become known as the Genius Award. His latest film, Brother from Another Planet, is currently playing in Philadelphia and opens at Suburban Theaters this weekend. A little later, we'll meet Maggie Renzi, who has produced several of Sayles' movies and played the lead in Return of the Secaucus Seven. She's also featured in Liana and Brother from Another Planet. Sayles and Renzi live together in Hoboken, New Jersey. Welcome to Fresh Air, John.
Hi,
Sayles.
How you doing? I have to correct one thing.
Go ahead.
Clan of the Cave Bear has mutated. It originally was going to be a six-hour TV miniseries, and now it's going to be one, maybe two features. So it's going to come out as a feature sometime this year with Daryl Hannah in the lead.
Oh, great. Well, so you started writing novels and short stories. What attracted you to writing screenplays and making movies?
I think I had always been interested in movies. I certainly saw as many more movies and watched more TV as a kid than I read books. So that was sort of my primary, you know, art that I was exposed to, if you want to call it an art. So that it was something that actually came first before writing fiction. The thing about writing fiction is that you don't have to raise money to write a book. You just sort of sit down and do it, you know, and then you try to get it published. Whereas with movies, there's this whole period of fundraising and pitching the story, or in the case of a couple of my movies, Secaucus 7 and Brother from Another Planet, actually doing work for other people in order to get the money to finance it yourself. But it was just something that I was always interested in and always felt, even before I knew that there was a division between director, writer, and editor, in my head it seemed like the same job to me, that you know, you would make a movie the way you would write a book, that you would control all those aspects of it.
Does it ever seem ironic to you that you, the man who's been hailed as one of our most sensitive and intelligent independent filmmakers, mm-hmm. got your start in movies writing for Roger Corman, who's, you know, the B-movie master?
Yeah, maybe not. I mean, it sort of makes a good story, but it's not that ironic to me, in that there were a lot of those movies that I enjoyed as a kid. My criterion for taking a movie on as a job to write the screenplay for it, if I'm not going to direct it, is basically, is there a movie that could be made from the subject matter that I would like to see? So when I approach a movie like Piranha, I always say, well, what kind of this kind of movie did I ever like? And so I'd go back to something like Them or The Return of, you know, the Body Snatchers or Invaders from Mars or something like that. And I said, oh, boy, I really liked those movies when I was a kid, and then I'll see them again. I'll say, I still like those movies. Can I make this into a movie like that if I'm going to work in this genre? I think movies just like fiction have room for a lot of different kinds of things, and one of them is just pure entertainment kind of movies, you know, that are more entertaining if you care about the characters, but even if the characters are sort of secondary. I mean, there's almost a tradition in horror movies of thin characters and bad acting. Sometimes you like the movie despite the thin characters and bad acting, you know, and if you can flesh the characters out a little bit and get a little better acting in them, you like them even more.
In those scripts, did you put in any in-jokes or film jokes that you thought people would get and really enjoy?
Actually, I think most of the film jokes are put there by the directors, Joe Dante and to a lesser extent Louis T, because he doesn't put quite as many in as Joe does. But a lot of times that's the director who's just sort of sees something and says, oh, why don't you hold a copy of Howl during the werewolf movie or something like that. I'll put jokes in there that are almost only to entertain myself. You know, in Alligator, I had there's a character early on who you never meet who's eaten by an alligator down in a sewer, and he's a sewer worker. And I had him named Ed Norton, which is the name of the character on The Honeymooners who works in the sewer. But you never hear his whole name. You just hear that his name was Norton, and later on you hear that his name was Ed. And if you're really paying attention, you get it. But it was mostly to entertain myself while I was writing it.
One of the traits that you share with Roger Corman is that you both know how to make movies on a low budget, mm-hmm. although the movies you make now, I think, are kind of different than the typical Corman films. Did
One of the things that was interesting about New World Pictures when Roger Corman owned it is not only did he make, you know, sort of pure exploitation films, he also imported and distributed movies like Cries and Whispers and The Tin Drum. So he always had those sort of two faces to his distribution company.
When you were working with him, did you learn any cost-cutting devices that you've been since applying to your own movies?
Basically, what I got to be on the set of Piranha, I got to talk to the directors who worked on the other pictures I wrote there, and I learned a lot about what costs money and what doesn't, what's are hard costs and what are sort of flexible costs. You know, things like the raw stock is a hard cost. The equipment rental is a hard cost. Lodging, the time that you take to shoot something, moving the camera, those are flexible costs. You can actually still make the picture and not move the camera so much if, in fact, you have a story that can stand not moving the camera that much. You can shoot for 4 weeks instead of eight if, in fact, you think there's any way that you can get it in the can in 4 weeks. You know, I basically got an idea about what costs money on a set and how to get in your priorities so that when I've sat down to write things that I knew I was going to finance or that we were going to make for very little money, I've been able to think of the script of, okay, what can we do well for very little money and what is just going to cost more than we can possibly afford and we'll have to do it, you know, a quarter of what it could be because we just don't have the money to support that idea or that scene. And so I've often rewritten scenes thinking, how can I get the same effect within the movie and the same emotion out of the audience but not set it in this place or do it in this way that's going to cost us so much money?
Is there an example?
In Brother from Another Planet, you know, there's a scene where the men in black or these intergalactic bounty hunters show up, and I wanted them showing up at Port Authority bus terminal. The idea being they don't come from outer space. They've been here for a long time, and this is sort of their beat. We checked out how much Port Authority was going to cost, and I had to alter the scene because we just couldn't afford to shoot there. So instead, we took some sound in Port Authority and actually shot on some escalator stairs in a bank late at night where we could get in for almost no money, and then put the sound there so you feel like you're seeing a close shot of a couple guys who are in a huge bus station. You know, that's sort of a technical way to get around it. But very often it really does mean, okay, I got to get the brother from another planet from Ellis Island to Harlem. He's got to cross the river somehow. What's the easiest way to do this? I can have him sort of jump on a ferry boat. Can we afford the ferry boat? No, we can't afford the ferry boat. So we'll have him see a ferry boat. We'll hear a splash. The next thing we'll see is him on something, which in fact is the boat that took us out to Ellis Island and brought us back. But there he is on a boat in the Hudson. And if we're very careful about what we show, it can look like he's on the ferry boat. You can work around things and sort of get a lot of the same things. There's certain things that just wouldn't, you know, that you can't make for very little money, that need some size.
But, like the Ten Commandments.
Yeah, you know. but Roger Corman was fond of saying you can make any picture for any amount of budget. It will just look different. If it looks too much different, it's not going to work.
My guest is John Sayles, if you're just joining us. Why did you want to direct? After writing screenplays, did you think that, you know, you could do a better job with your own work than you saw other directors doing with it?
I had actually always wanted to direct. That was the first idea. As I said before, writing, directing, and editing really seemed like parts of the same process to me. I always feel like the writing is the first draft, the directing is the second draft, and the editing is the third draft. So my main reason to get into screenwriting alone was to get to the point where I could direct my own stuff. And that lately that seems to be the surest way to get directing work, you know, either to have enough money so you can become the producer and hire yourself as the director, which is one way to do it. The other way is a lot of people, Larry Kasdan, Paul Schrader, Walter Hill, a lot of the sort of newer directors came up through the screenwriting ranks, which is not the old studio way where people came out of the trailer department or the montage department or, you know, from theater or whatever, and writers rarely got to direct things. Lately, people have been able to write a couple screenplays, have one be a big hit, and then say, oh, you can have my next screenplay if you let me direct it. And a few people have even been successful in sort of coming up with a story that everybody wants to do and tying themselves to it as director on their first time out, which is very lucky. But a few people have been successful doing that. So it was always, you know, it wasn't that I was disappointed in how my screenplays were turning out. It was always something that I wanted to do both.
The first film that you directed was Return of the Secaucus mm-hmm. 7, which was about a group of people who were entering their 30s who mm-hmm. used to be good friends in the 60s and were having a reunion. Do you think that the 60s is a subject that the studios have never really handled very accurately in movies?
Yeah, to a certain extent. You know, they've gotten little bits and pieces of it. Easy Rider, which wasn't a studio movie, caught some of the spirit of the time. Certainly, you know, it was a very popular movie among people who were in college or that age back then. And then the studios ran off and made 100 bad copies of it, 100 bad, you know, campus movies and drug movies and stuff like that. And they never really quite got it. But it's such a, you know, even within that time, things weren't monolithic. There were so many different facets to that one of the problems was is they just sort of looked the cover of Life magazine and said, oh, hippies, you know, or oh, drugs, or oh, revolutionaries, and that's all they did. And they never recognized the diversity of the people, the fact that most college students even weren't that political. You know, they didn't even go to the big marches or anything like that. They just sort of watched from the sidelines. That it was a matter of there were more people than usual getting involved in those things, and they were getting a lot of publicity, especially considering that they weren't that huge in number compared to the amount of people in college or even the amount of people that age who were of draft age at that time. But I think, it's one of those things where until it gets to be something that really people are making money on it, I don't think too many people are going to want to rehash that stuff. And when they do, they'll sort of I don't know what the word is. They'll do what has happened to the 20s or the 40s or whatever. There will be this thing that will romanticize and sentimentalize it. They'll squeeze it down to a few easily accessible images. I mean, one of the things that we try to do in Baby It's You is really go back. Amy Robinson, who brought the story to me and who was one of the co-producers, worked very carefully with the costumers so that people weren't just dressed like hippies. You realize that there were a few people who dressed like hippies and a lot of people who dressed in a million different other styles at that time. If you look at the old yearbooks and those kind of things and not just in, okay, what do you think immediately when you think of 1966, you realize that there was a lot of diversity and that kind of thing. Whereas usually people do what they do when they do a 20s movie. They say, oh, flappers, you know, and they make three or four broad choices that just say 20s to people and they costume and direct the thing in a kind of shorthand.
A lot of people think of the movie The Big Chill as being the big dollar version mm-hmm. of Secaucus 7 and mm-hmm. of being I wouldn't say stealing from your mm-hmm. movie, but, you know, adapt from the idea that proved to be successful when you made it in Return of the Chicago mm-hmm. 7. What do you think of that movie, if you don't mind mm-hmm. saying? And do you think of it as being borrowed from your idea?
I don't know Kasdan, and I've never seen an interview where he talked about... Even he didn't really talk about The Big Chill that much. I don't think he does many interviews, and he certainly didn't talk about it in terms of relating to Secaucus 7. I thought it was a better than usual Hollywood movie, and that it actually, you know, was probably pretty hard to get made. I don't think anybody said, "Oh, please, we're going to give you lots of money, and we're going to let you make this, you know, sort of movie about a bunch of old friends talking over a weekend and, you know, relating with each other." I imagine he had his struggles getting it made. You know, it's a very different movie in my head than Secaucus 7, in that the people are, number one, very upwardly mobile in The Big Chill, and sort of the opposite in Secaucus 7. The people in Secaucus 7 are still much more political. The main difference is that, you know, Big Chill to me is a movie about people who are like realizing that they have either lost their ideals or maybe never had them in the first place. Whereas Secaucus 7 is about people who are desperately trying to hang on to their ideals, even though the world around them isn't as friendly as it used to be to those ideals. You know, the format is very similar. You know, it's to me, it's sort of like a Western. You know, you're going to have some horses and you're going to have a gunfight. You know, if you have a movie about a weekend reunion, people are going to make the beds, they're going to make dinner, they're going to talk about old times, and they're going to, you know, people who used to have tight relationships are going to rekindle them or not rekindle them or whatever, you know. I was happy that it did well. I mean, it's something that other people can use as a precedent to say, oh, no, it doesn't have to be a teen sex comedy, or it doesn't have to be, you know, a high-tech science fiction movie to get made and to make money and, you know, that kind of thing. And I like the soundtrack, too.
A lot of people assumed that it was a very autobiographical film and that you were someone who had probably undergone a transformation in the 60s and mm-hmm. was trying, like the people in your movie were, yeah. to hold on to those ideals. Was yeah. there any truth in that?
It's probably one of my least autobiographical films. I'd say in some ways Baby It's You is much more autobiographical. I mean, that situation, that high school situation, is a lot more familiar to me than, you know, the one that the people in the Secaucus 7 are. Secaucus 7 is definitely based on people that I know and know of and you know, like. But I came to politics and to, you know, being in college from a very different direction than a lot of them did. I was very suspicious of politics in general, not just student politics, when I was in school. And actually, I'm sort of less pessimistic and cynical than I was when I was younger. So in that way, it's not very autobiographical, although I'm very familiar with those people in that time.
In what ways, Baby It's You autobiographical?
Well, Amy Robinson, who brought me the story, went to Trenton High School in about 1966, and a lot of her experience went into that. I went to a very similar high school in upstate New York, very melting pot kind of high school, 2 years later. You know, I graduated in 68. We both went to sort of allegedly classy, liberal arts colleges and had to make that adjustment during about the same time. We both went from situations where we were really in the 50s to the late 60s, you know, like in 1 year, and had to make that kind of adjustment of, Jesus, what's happening to the world? So I was actually more familiar with the people, and more of the things that happened in it were things that I really had seen or done or whatever, whether it was from the male or the female perspective, because, you know, even when I do something autobiographical, it's not necessarily in only one character who's in the movie. So that in a way that took in more of my own experience. One of the nice things about working with Amy on that is that she could really tell me what was going on in the girls' locker room, in the girls' conversations, because high school is a place where the male and female, experience is very different. You know, it's really two different closed societies. And now and then you'll see a boy and girl walking hand in hand, and they aren't even talking that much. You know, they really don't know that much about each other's world. So she really had that perspective, and I had more of Sheik's perspective and knew what was going on in the boys' locker room and in their heads. And it gave us a nice kind of overview of the whole experience and of both characters rather than having it just be one character's story or the other's.
In Bibi, It's You, the two stars of the movie, Vincent Spano and Rosanna
yeah.
Arquette, have become pretty well-known mm-hmm. actors. And would you have wanted to work with people who were already famous in that movie?
It depends on what kind of famous. There at any one time are three or four actors who are not only somewhat box office names, but are also really good actors and really versatile actors. And it never hurts to work with those guys. Especially in that in Baby It's You, unlike Secaucus 7, there were definitely a star couple. You know, they were definitely the focus of the movie. In Secaucus 7, if we had had one name actor and the rest of the people were sort of in their first movie, it would have thrown people off. They would have said, well, why aren't we seeing more of Richard Dreyfuss or whoever it was, you know, who was the right age? And the weight of the movie, you know, and the casting would have been thrown off. Both Rosanna and Vincent had done a few movies. They weren't really names yet. But it wouldn't have hurt if they were good actors, and versatile actors, because both roles really demanded a lot. You couldn't just be that person. You had to be somebody who could play different sides of a character and not just sort of be one character, and that's all you can do, and you're well cast, and so you're fine in the role.
That's the only film that you've done so far that's been backed by a studio.
Yeah.
Did it hurt your ability to make decisions and be independent while you were directing? Did you have a lot of squabbles with the studio?
Not while I was directing. During the editing period, we had a lot of big fights over the final cut. I think finally what happened, and we ran into this problem when we were first trying to sell the story to studios, was that studios at that time were they were just sensing. They had a whiff of this rising genre of the teen sex comedy, and most of the studios that turned it down as a story, including 20th Century Fox, who originally had it was developed there originally, wanted it just to be a high school movie and not to go on to college and all that serious stuff about them growing up. They wanted it to sort of stay sort of a nice, at the most bittersweet kind of romantic sex comedy set in high school. And to us, the whole point of the movie was that they went on to college and that they had to grow up and you know, things had to change and they had to realize things about themselves. And I think what happened is that after they funded the movie in this kind of roundabout way in which Paramount sort of arranged a bank loan for the company that made the picture, so it wasn't a Paramount picture until it was done shooting. Then they appeared, they bought the picture from the bank, and then they were the studio of record, and they could say anything they wanted. So they really weren't present during the casting. They weren't present during the shooting. And during the editing, I think by that time they had decided, well, maybe this whole college thing isn't such a good idea, so let's cut down on that and emphasize the first part of the film. And that was not what I wanted to do at all, and it wasn't the script I had given them in the first place. So we had quite a few battles over the final cut, and eventually was the cut that I wanted, but not without a lot of bad business in between.
What power do you have? You know, how do you throw? How do you make use of whatever power you do
have
in an argument? Yeah,
the power
like
that I had in that was sort of Gandhi-like power. you know, to throw gasoline on yourself and immolate yourself publicly. the only power that I had at that time, I was in the Directors Guild and I was in the Writers Guild, which I'm still in. And in both of those guilds, there is contract language that says that if you don't like what happened with your picture, you can take your name off it and put a pseudonym in place. So I was actually taken off the editing of the picture for a month while they did their own version of it because we were disagreeing that much and I wasn't going to do what they wanted me to do with it. And I made sure that I got as much publicity as I possibly could, and I just kept telling them, I'm not bluffing. I'm really going to take my name off this thing. What you want me to do with this thing has nothing to do with the original concept of the picture, and I think it's making it worse, and I think you're not going to make any more money. So basically I had only the power, sort of like Gandhi did with Britain, is if you have an entity who cares about their image in the world. And at that time, Paramount cared about their reputation as not being a studio who would step on some poor little independent director and take his picture away from him. You have the power, if you're willing to stick it out, to embarrass them. and that's the only power you have. You have nothing contractually if you're, you know, have the usual director's contract that says you have final cut or anything like that. And so I just kept saying, look, you know, I'm not going to say nice things about this picture if I think you've wrecked it. I'm not going to put my name on it. And it's going to be a very public kind of mugging if this happens. And finally what happened is they did their own cut of the picture and test marketed it. And it didn't market any better than the cut that I had been working on had marketed. So I think they finally just sort of shrugged their shoulders and say, well, it's not going to do good financially either way, we might as well skip the bad publicity and give it back to this guy. And so I got to cut it the way I wanted to. They didn't exactly kill themselves distributing it. I think they just felt like, you know, if we push this movie, we're just going to lose more money than we already have. And so let's cut our losses and just sort of put it open in a couple cities so we can make the ancillary sales, which is pretty much what they did. So I've since talked to distributors who had to beg for the picture and some who begged for it who didn't get it. You know, so it had a very, very limited run theatrically.
Did I noticed your next movie after that was another independent film. Did you decide after that experience with Paramount to stay away from the studios if you could?
I think it was a mutual decision. I think the studios decided to stay away from me and I decided to stay away from them. You know, The Brother from Another Planet was a movie that we actually made because we were trying for about a year to raise money for this other historical film I want to make that will cost between $2 and $3 million if we ever get it off the ground, set in West Virginia in the 1920s. And the money fell through at the last minute. You know, we were casting people and stuff like that. And I was sort of bummed out about that, even though I sort of never really believe the money's going to come through until, you know, we've gone through this so many times with the other pictures. You know, both Baby It's You and Leanna were on and off a million times before they finally happened. So I just said to Peggy Reiske and Maggie Renzi, the producers of the West Virginia film, would you like to produce another really low-budget film because I've got some money in the bank? Because in that year, last year, I wrote 5 movies for other people as well as writing Brother from Another Planet. And I have this idea and it's, you know, set in Harlem and here's the basic story. And they said, well, it sounds pretty wild, but sure. So they started producing. We wanted to shoot it before winter, before there was snow on the ground. And I wrote the movie while they were already producing in about a week. Basically, it was one of those things where I just wanted to do it. We'd been messing with studios for years trying to get financing for the other pictures, and I just didn't want to hear their opinion. I didn't want them to tell me if I would only write a part for such and such an actor, they could do it, or this or that or the other thing. I knew I could. I had enough movie to get it in, money to get it in the can, and I could make enough money doing more screenplays to get it through the laboratory process. So why bother with those guys if I didn't have to listen to it, you know, and go through all that stuff? Because I wasn't intending to change anything anyway, so why get into the debate, which we'd been doing for a year on this other picture, if in fact we didn't need the money in the first place? So we didn't even bother to take the brother around to studios. We just sort of did it really quickly, you know, with our own money. And there's things that would be better if we had more money and more time. But to get more money and more time, you always have to give something else up, which is control over the picture. And you know, that's after doing Baby It's You, that's just something I didn't want to do. You know, I pretty much let it be known that I didn't want to direct anything unless I had final cut and casting control in my contract. And, you know, I had a executive at one of the studios who I actually like say to me, look, you know, if we gave it to you, we'd have to give it to anybody. And they're right. You know, I've never made them that much money. So it's a precedent that they just don't want to set.
Most of The Brother from Another Planet is shot on location in Harlem. Mm-hmm. Did you have to do any community public relations before setting up the film there? Because recently there have been several instances where people in communities have been very upset with the way they've been treated by the filmmakers and have tried to, you know, boycott the opening of the movie. I don't know that you should have expected a reaction like that, but how did you lay the groundwork for being there so you'd get a good reaction?
Yeah, we didn't do it in any very organized fashion. One of the we had some people who lived up there, who worked on the film, who were good as liaison people. Randy Fraser, who plays a small part in the film, is a guy who's acted up there and directed up there and all kinds of things, and he was one of our location scouts. And he helped us with knowing, you know, getting in with a lot of our location, you know, locations and places to put up the crew while we were shooting and that kind of thing. Basically, we just made sure that all the people working on the film were aware that we were guests in a community and not the usual film crew who comes in and thinks they can take over and, you know, everybody should bend over backwards just because you're a film company, you know. So we really, I wanted definitely to make Harlem a character in the movie. We certainly weren't a big enough crew or a powerful enough crew to shut the place down and make everybody get off the streets and then repopulate it with actors playing the residents of Harlem. So in a lot of cases, you know, almost everybody out of focus and even a few people in focus are just residents of Harlem who happened to be going about their business while we were shooting there. So we were able to retain a bit of a documentary feeling to the street scenes and things like that, which is something that I wanted. But basically, it was really one-on-one kind of diplomacy, and people were really nice and very gracious. And so it was a lot of fun to shoot up there. You know, we got the title from the movie because we were going through a lot of different title ideas. And, you know, finally our production assistants, when people would come up and say, what's this shooting over here? And they say, well, it's about this brother from another planet. And, oh, I'll go see that, you know. And so pretty soon the movie became The Brother from Another Planet.
Since you couldn't cordon off the streets and repopulate the streets mm-hmm. with actors, did you have a lot of scenes ruined by people who behaved as if they were on the news or something and started waving at the camera?
Not too much. You put your production assistants off camera and you. One of the things about this film, one of the reasons we were able to shoot it for, you know, $350,000 in 4 weeks is that the main character is mute and he doesn't talk. So very often we were shooting without sound. And when you're shooting without sound, your people just off camera can say, excuse me, can you walk around this instead of walking in front of it, you know? And then they can have a whole conversation about the film, you know, 2 feet from the camera, and as long as they're not in front of it, and you've got a good actor like Joe Morton who can keep his concentration while people are sort of looking at him and talking about him as he's acting, you can get the shot off. So it actually helped quite a bit that it was one of the things I had in mind when I made the character mute, as a matter of fact, is that we could shoot a lot of what's called MOS footage, which means that you're not taking sync sound at the same time.
Did you get a lot of advice or suggestions from Harlem residents about how the Harlem people in your film should be behaving or about what kinds of behavior would be appropriate for the brother from another planet?
Not especially. I mean, you know, now and then some, you know, we were shooting all night long we got some wino advice from some winos who were out there all night about, you know, how you set a fire in a trash barrel. But pretty much the movie was written, you know, just as you see it when we went in there. And then the actors sort of take over and they sort of flesh out what you've written. They don't necessarily have to change the lines to do that. And, you know, the actors felt pretty comfortable with the movie as written. I had lived in and around other big city black neighborhoods, not Harlem particularly, but other neighborhoods like Harlem. So I had a feeling for, you know, once again, the diversity of a neighborhood like that, that it's not this monolithic slum or anything like that. That one of the things that interested me about, you know, having something set in Harlem is that it's there are, you know, upper class, upper middle class, lower middle class, working class, you know, people who are totally out of work altogether. There's, you know, sort of a criminal subculture. There's all these people who are living side by side and literally side by side because they're black and they're all stuck in this sort of same place, you know, because it's really a city of its own, you know, and it has its own little economy and those kind of things and its own culture and its own, you know, sort of spirit to it. And what the people in the city mainly have in common is that most of them are black. And that's a very interesting thing to see people, you know, and we certainly ran into it in the different responses we'd get on the street, you know, from people who had all day to hang out and watch us shoot to people who really just sort of looked at it as they were going to downtown to work or wherever they went to work. So, you know, people would just sort of ask what it was about mostly. And one of the things that was nice about it is we knew we had an audience right while we were making the film because the response to what the movie was about was so positive.
Speaking with John Sayles, let me ask you about an earlier film, Leanna. Mm-hmm. It was a movie about a lesbian.
Mm-hmm.
It's a subject that I know studios have begun to tackle, though.
Oh, well, a little bit.
A little bit. Yes.
They began and they stopped, I think.
Now, probably a lot of people, though, resented your handling of it because you were a man writing mm-hmm. about a lesbian's experience. Did you get a lot of from lesbian women? Did you get a lot of
less than I expected?
Uh-huh.
Actually, what we found is that the reaction that we got to that from sort of interest groups, whether they were specifically lesbian or just feminist groups. Varied according to from country to country, sort of the period in which the feminist movement that there was going through. I figure that if I had made the movie 7 years earlier, there would have been people who would pick at the movie without ever going in and seeing it, which certainly has happened with other movies recently. Whereas with Leanna, people at least saw the movie first and nobody picketed it. We had one of our first screenings was in Boston. It was a sneak preview before the movie had opened. And word got out and at least half the audience, maybe more, were gay women who had heard what it was about and really came with chips on their shoulders. And people were hissing like in the first 10 minutes because they had come not to like the movie. And by the end of it, people were applauding and very emotional and teary and all that kind of stuff that we wanted to happen with it. So I think the women's movement and the gay women's movement had matured to a point here where although people had their problems with it, they could sort of go to it and discuss it and like what they liked and dislike what they disliked. And even if at first they sort of had a chip on their shoulder because it was directed by a man, that wasn't the overwhelming factor. In Germany, we ran into this weird thing where some of the women's groups just wouldn't accept it at all and didn't even bother to see it. Others actually liked it very much, so you get very varying reviews of it. But the general public, because there had been a couple gay women's films which had been very, to them, very off-putting, and I didn't see the film, so I don't know if they were great films or not, just sort of labeled it as a woman's film, and nobody went to it. You know, or not as many people as it just didn't cross over. In some cities in the States, we had the problem in a couple cities in the South where because there was so much of a gay audience in the first 2 weeks and it really was very popular in the gay community that other people got afraid to go. Men were afraid to go because there were all these gay women there and they were afraid that they would get hissed out of the theater or whatever they think is going to happen when they're around with a lot of women. It made them nervous. And straight women were afraid to go because they thought that, oh, people will think I'm gay if I go to this movie or whatever. It didn't happen in more sophisticated cities or cities where people are more used to being around great numbers of gay people. But certainly in the States, I always say that I wish there were more gay women because we would have done better with the film because that turned out to be our best audience.
You've acted in most of your movies. In Return of the Secaucus 7, you play someone who never left the town that the college is set in and you now have a family and are very financially strapped. In Leanna, you play a very obnoxious teacher. I think you're
right,
a teacher,
right?
Who's always trying to make it with Leanna, being really crude. In The Brother from Another Planet, you play one of the extraterrestrial bounty hunters, one of the men in black. In a way, all the roles that you've played in your own movies are either unsavory or outsiders.
Uh-huh.
Is that intentional? How do you cast yourself?
Well, I basically act in movies that I make because I like to act. It's something that has always helped my writing and vice versa. It really helps me to look at a screenplay and basically in my head play all the parts. I realize, okay, if I was an actor and I had to play this, would I know what I was doing? Would I know why I'm here? You know, what my relationship to this other character is? The outsiders or the outsider basically kind of character is because while I'm directing, I really don't have the time to work with the other actors that much to play somebody who's known people for years or been in a relationship for years or whatever. So I tend to take a smaller part who can just sort of come on and do their business and have whatever meeting they have with the sort of central characters and then step out. It's just I think the people who have directed themselves in lead parts successfully generally are people who have one persona that they play time and again, you know, Clint Eastwood or Woody Allen or, you know, Buster Keaton or Charlie Chaplin. They basically had a persona which sort of took care of themselves and they weren't playing different characters. And in that I'm more interested in sort of character acting kind of stuff and playing different kinds of people. I sort of prefer to limit it to pretty small roles and people who are sort of out of the mainstream of the lives of the main characters.
Could you ever play in a movie opposite Maggie Renzi, who you've collaborated with for many years and also lived together with? Would it be hard to do that since you're already so close?
Not really. You know, I've known a lot of the people that I've acted with fairly well and have totally different relationship off camera than with on. You know, she's a good actress, and so it wouldn't be impossible. You know, it is hard to work with. It is hard for both of us to stop being, you know, on the days when Maggie has acted in movies that she's also been one of the co-producers of and the unit manager and all that kind of thing. She's had to say, okay, somebody take over those jobs for me today so I can just concentrate on the acting. On the days when I act, basically, I don't get to do that, you know, so I have to just sort of stop everything and say, okay, give me a stand and I'm going to look at this thing through the camera. And then I'm going to act, and then I really have to concentrate very hard, but I only get to start, like, after I say action, you know? And the nice thing is that when I go up on my lines, nobody knows it because I just say, cut, I didn't like that. You know, that wasn't going in the right direction, and people don't know that I just went blank.
Is it hard to direct Maggie since you are lovers? Is it hard to direct a lover with the same kind of objectivity that you direct someone else?
I think it's always hard to direct anybody who you know in a, you know, as sort of outside of the thing. It's also easier, you know, in some ways. You know well what they're going to sound like here, and so maybe you can lead them to something. You know more of their history, so that when you talk about something that's like what you want them to do, you know something out of their past. You don't have to use something very general, but it's also hard because you have a personal relationship of some kind. And I think the hardest thing is that you tend to, when you know somebody very well, you tend to take for granted. You don't do as much of, oh, that was great, let's try it again. You just sort of say, let's try it again. And of course, every actor, when they just hear, let's try it again, what they hear is, oh, you really messed up. We have to do another take because you're such a lousy actor. You know, and so it's something that, you know, I'm trying to get better at keeping in mind is when I know, and, you know, it often happens that an actor comes and I'll hear from, oh, I think I'm really doing terrible in this movie. They just don't even talk to me. And usually what it means is they're fine and the director has so many other problems that they even forget to say, yeah, that was fine. You know, when really what they mean is, thank God I've got an actor who's taking care of himself and I can deal with the other problems on the set. I'd say that's the main difficulty is that you in the work situation, you tend to take things for granted that you shouldn't, because you can take them for granted in real life. You don't have to say, oh, it's great to see you every 15 minutes.
Let's talk a little bit about your background. You grew up in Schenectady. Mm-hmm. When you were in high school, were you like known as the writer or?
No, I don't think I was known as anything except when I was on sports teams, you know, and then that changed from season to season. So I was a little better in football than I was in basketball. And so, you know, as known as somebody who started at football and who didn't start at basketball. And that's about the only notoriety I think that I had at all, you know, in high school. The high school I went to, you know, academic success was not, you know, but anything that had anything to do with social standing. In fact, it probably had a negative, you know, relationship to it. And I wasn't that good in school. You know, I was okay.
So that means you were very popular?
No, I actually, you know, I don't think people thought that much about me one way or the other. You know, I had some friends, and you know, but basically I wasn't a star in anything. And certainly any writing I did, you know, was just sort of for assignments or for my own amusement. And I didn't show it to anybody. So, you know, it wasn't like part of my identity has never really been I am a writer. You know, it's always been something I like to do, but it was never a way that I identified myself or other people identified me, you know, until I actually had something published. And then they say, oh, he's the guy who wrote that book. He must be a writer.
When you were in, say, senior in high school, what did you really think you were going to end up doing for a living?
I tried not to think about it because I really I didn't know anybody who wrote books for a living. I didn't even know you could make a living writing books. I was really that out of it. I didn't know how you... I thought you just sort of sent away. I've said this before, like you send away to Battle Creek, Michigan for those little things that come in cereal boxes, and that the reward was they published your book and people read it. I didn't know this thing about you got paid for it, you know, or, you know, and you hardly do. I mean, you know, compared to other kinds of work or other kinds of writing even. So that wasn't one of them. And I didn't even know when I got out of college, you know, I sort of was interested in movies and had not the slightest idea, except that maybe through writing I could eventually get into working in movies. But I didn't go to film school. I didn't know anybody who did. I was a psychology major in college, but that was just because that was the easiest course, and I had to do the least, you know, requisite courses in order to get through it. And I liked animals, so I got to take a lot of animal behavior classes. So, you know, when I got out of college, I really just had to make a living, and the only stuff I had done was factory work and working in hospitals as an orderly, and that's what I went back to. You know, I had done that summer vacations when I was in high school.
Did you think you'd be trapped doing that forever?
No, because I don't have that kind of patience. I really didn't think in the future that much. I really, you know, I didn't have any master plan, and to a certain extent, I still don't. You know, I really don't like to think more than a couple weeks ahead of time.
In Return of the Secaucus 7, you play the role of someone who grew up in the town of the college mm-hmm. that everyone attended, and you never left that town.
Right.
Did you ever think that you'd be in that position in Schenectady? Did you ever feel like, I really have to get out of here? How am I going to do it?
I didn't live in Schenectady pretty much from the time that I went to college on. I mean, I didn't go back there after being in college. I went to Albany, New York, which is nearby, but not the same place. And after that, I lived in Atlanta. And after that, I lived in East Boston. So I really didn't feel like I was going to get caught in a town. Although that character was very familiar to me. It was one of the reasons I played that character is that it was the one that I felt the most comfortable with among all those people. I mean, it was the one that I had to work the least to do it because I knew I was going to have my hands full shooting this, my first feature film in 5 weeks, you know, with almost no money. And I did want to play a part in it. And so I chose somebody who I wouldn't have to work on my diction or my grammar or anything, you know, that I could sort of have him speak pretty much the way that I talk. And I wouldn't have to act that much, even though his situation was different than me. He's certainly somebody I could have been.
Unions have been a theme in several mm-hmm. of your stories and also in a forthcoming movie mm-hmm. that you're working on. Were unions an important part of, like, your family life? Were your parents in unions?
Yeah, they were, too. You know, they were in the teachers' union because both of them were teacher, and my father was the sort of shop steward equivalent for a while in the teachers' union where he was in. And then later he became a principal, so he went on the other side but was always the one on the other side who was trying to get more money for the teachers and getting into hot water because of it. General Electric pretty much runs Schenectady. I mean, it's the big factory. And it's the headquarters for General Electric. So there was always union activity there. The electrical, i.e., whatever it was, union was often sort of threatening strikes, and the company was threatening to move to the South. And so I was around that kind of thing. A lot of the reason that I'm interested in unions also is that I'm interested in the whole concept of union with a small u, of how do people get together, what interests bring them together, and what interests split them apart. So this next movie I want to do, Mate One, which is set in West Virginia in 1920, is at the time when the United Mine Workers was first sort of getting off the ground. But really it's about union in that larger sense of here are some of the most individualistic people in the world, the, you know, mountaineers of West Virginia, who have a hard time even getting along with their relatives sometimes. You know, they're very strong, but they're so individualistic that strength often turns into a liability because they're standing alone against everybody. And even the idea of a trade union was tough for them to accept, even though it was really the only way to go and have any power. But in that situation, it was a trade union where in order to make sure that the companies couldn't just bring in scabs from anywhere, they had to accept both black miners from Alabama and immigrants off the boat from Ellis Island into their own union and into their own community somehow so that they could get these scabs to walk out of the mine and be part of the union. Also, you know, the idea of one of the things that unfortunately helps people get together is violence and violence from the outside and sharing violence. And I'm all those things interest me of how do people form communities.
I wonder what you think of unions in the film industry. You belong to the Screenwriters Guild.
Yeah.
Yet you've made movies with actors who aren't in the union. It's mm-hmm. it's cheaper that way.
Yeah, so they're guilds for one thing.
Uh-huh.
I've been in three guilds and I'm still in two of them. I've been in the Writers Guild, Directors Guild, and the Screen Actors Guild. I had to quit the Directors Guild, not so much actually because they're actually a very good guild as far as getting their members money, but as a financier and a movie maker, I can't afford to pay a director, assistant director, second assistant director, and production manager, DGA minimums, and still make a movie for $350,000 and justify to the rest of the crew why these three, you know, guild members are getting paid, you know, six or seven times what they're getting paid for the same 4 weeks of work. A guild is different than a union in that the idea of a guild is, number one, that it is an elite core of people who have a certain kind of skill and nobody else has that kind of skill. A guild automatically then is a kind of elitist organization, which I have some problems with, but not so many. The other thing is that the way that those guilds operate is that you never work in a non-guild situation. You're not supposed to anyway. Whereas in a union, very often it says if you walk into a union shop, you're a union member, but if you work in another shop, you don't have to worry about it. So when I was in the Meatpackers Union, I was free to go somewhere else and work in another industry doing physical labor. And if it wasn't organized, I didn't have to be in the union. Whereas once you're in these guilds, once you're either in or you're out. You don't work for anybody else as a screenwriter unless it's as a guild screenwriter, and you don't work for anybody else as an actor. Basically, you know, as a sort of a filmmaker and somebody who often finances, you know, our own films, Secaucus 7 we did without the Screen Actors Guild. And you pay for that. So you can only use actors who aren't – you can't use any actors who are in. So you're limited to people, I think, of a certain age, because after about the age of 32 or so, most of the people you're going to get who are going to be any good at all are going to be in one of the guilds. So one of the reasons we made Leanne a second, even though I wrote it before I wrote Secaucus 7, is we needed some older actors in that to make it work. And I just felt like I wasn't going to get good enough people unless we could go with guild salaries.
Are there any values that you have now as a filmmaker that you think as you get older and as you become more well-known that you're in danger of compromising?
I get the chance to make movies so rarely that I don't get much chance to compromise my values. And the values I started with are I don't think that they're not that hard to hold on to as long as, you know, my final purpose has always been to make movies that I like and that I think other people will like and that I would want to go to. It hasn't been to make Hollywood movies or big budget movies or movies that gross over a certain amount of dollars. And I've always tried to be honest with investors if we've gotten other investors and not make something that's definitely going to lose money. I've always tried to, you know, make something for a price that particular movie, being realistic about it, can at least gross this much and people have a good chance of breaking even and some chance of making a profit. So I really haven't had much of that kind of problem. You know, one of the things that's always difficult is leaving people out, because people, the technicians you know and the actors you know who become your friends, get to work in things that they would want to go see so rarely. You know, they have to make a living, so they work in all kinds of films. And so rarely is it something that they actually say to their friends, I just worked on this picture. I think it's going to be really good. Let's go see it. That you always are in a situation of leaving people out, you know, the next time you go because you don't have a part for them or whatever. Reading actors for The Brother from Another Planet, there were a half dozen black actors who came in to read for the main role who just weren't right for that role, but I'd love to have in another movie, and maybe I'll get to. The woman who played Randy Sue in it, Carolyn Aaron, was somebody who I had auditioned for a play years ago, and she came in second. But I remembered her from that audition and eventually got to work from her. I mean, that's one of the most frustrating things is just knowing that there's not a part of, you know, there's not a technical role or a, you know, acting role for somebody who you would like to work with again.
We only have a couple of minutes left, but I'm wondering what some of your favorite movies are that you've ever seen.
Oh God, that I've ever seen. I can never remember that kind of. I like a real broad range of different kinds of things. You know, I didn't even see a foreign movie with subtitles until I was in college. So, you know, most of what I saw when I was a kid were pretty much genre movies and movies on television, stuff like that. So I've liked horror movies and I've liked westerns and I've liked action movies and then there's the whole, you know, I like most of the Italian neorealist stuff. I like Kurosawa's movies a lot. There's a guy named Ermanno Olmi. I like his movies a lot. But like somebody asked me about last year, what were my favorite movies? And they really ranged from, Sugarcane Alley to Splash to The Terminator to, Spinal Tap, The Killing Fields, to sort of well-intentioned, big-budget, liberal Hollywood movies to little movies made from almost no money at all.
Do you have a closet full of scripts that you're waiting to either produce or sell?
I got about 6 ideas. I've got 2 scripts already written that I want to make. One that I want somebody else to make that I don't need to direct that I think would be a nice movie. I've got 2 or 3 ideas that I eventually will try to make into movies. I try to always have 1 or 2 low-budget ideas that could be made for $500,000 or less so that, if I'm not successful in sort of attracting the $2 to $3 million range money, I'll still be able to get back in the ball game and make another movie.
Do you want to one day make a multi-million-dollar epic film?
Well, if we make this West Virginia thing, it will be, $3 million is multi-million-dollar film. Baby It's You was $3 million. That was a multi-million-dollar film. It was a tri-million-dollar film movie. Not just for the sake of making something big. If there was a specific project and that's what it cost and I thought that it had a very good chance of making that money back, sure, I wouldn't have anything against it. But, not just to say that I've made a big movie and I've spent a lot of money on it.
One last question. Some people really believe that working with frugal budgets keeps you creative. What do you think? You've certainly had a lot of experience doing that.
Having some limitations helps keep you creative. When you can shoot 360-degree coverage and do anything you want and shoot endlessly, you have to have an awful lot of self-discipline. Whereas sometimes the outside, but all my movies would have been better if I had more money and more time. I always look at them and I say, at the time I'm shooting them, I know they could be better.